And Kathy was in the basement later in the day, checking some things. The front doorbell rang. This was the next day now. It was her Aunt Teresa. George had met the woman once before at his mother-in-law's before he and Kathy were married. Teresa had been a nun at one time. Now she had three children. George never did learn the exact reason for her departure from the order. But here the former nun stood in the doorway, a short, thin woman in her early 30s, plainly clad in a worn black wool winter coat and galoshes. Her face was tired but ruddy from the cold. They brought her in. I'll skip that. This former nun was so terrorized and bothered by the sense of strange presences and the cold and the other things that we've been reading about, particularly in one room, she just refused to stay and up and left. Now let's skip on to the next little event. George began to get so disturbed at the events going on in the house, he started checking out on the history of the house. Among other places he went to was the Amityville Historical Society. They had some interesting information for George, particularly about the very location of his house. Now remember, this terrible murder where every member of the family was shot had occurred in this house. He discovered some things that went back behind that and beyond it. It seems that the Shinnecock Indians used land on the Amityville River as an enclosure for the sick, the mad, and the dying. These unfortunates were penned up until they died of exposure. However, the record at the Amityville Historical Society noted that the Shinnecocks did not use this tract as a consecrated burial mound because they believed it to be infested with demons. Now, I'm telling you, demons have assigned territories. There are certain cities that we go into that just immediately open up. One of the cities we've been negotiating with is Chicago. It's like Los Angeles. Someone beat the devil back from the territory. You've got to give old Dwight L. Moody some credit. Los Angeles is an area that is open to the gospel. There are other cities. Lubbock, for example, is blossoming. I couldn't figure out why that we weren't getting response out of Amarillo until I found out that's where the witches hold their convention every year. That's when I got so mad I was determined to stay there right through the convention. If I don't tell some of you anything else, you better learn how to combat the devil or move from some places. You wonder why there's so much evil going on in the Middle East, in Iran and Iraq. During the tribulation, the book of Revelation says, reveals that 200 million demons have been chained in that area that will be released. Well, think of the ones that aren't chained. I don't mean to put down New England. We've proven our love of New England. We've stayed there through thick and thin for 10 years. But after the great revivals of Jonathan Edwards, when he literally he read a sermon and people hung on to the pews under such conviction for fear they'd slip into hell. But once that territory turned to self-righteousness, and the devil began to move into that territory, it was infested. It's one of the hardest areas in the world to take the gospel. That's why you read so many of these stories in that area. Demons have territories. They're more comfortable in some areas than others. And I just threw that in. We're going to be teaching biblically on it. Right now I'm just looking for evidence of their existence. The record noted that the Shinnecocks did not use this tract as a consecrated burial mound because they believed it to be infested with demons, the place where this house was built. For how many uncounted centuries the Shinnecocks carried on in this manner, no one really knows. But in the late 1600s, white settlers eased the first Americans out of the area, sending them further out on Long Island. To this day, Shinnecocks still own land, property, and businesses on the eastern tip of the island. One of the more notorious settlers who came to the newly named Amityville in those days was a John Ketchum, or Ketchum, who had been forced out of Salem, Massachusetts, for practicing witchcraft. John set up residence within 500 feet of where George now lived. A little too cold in here, Mike. John set up residence within 500 feet of where George now lived and continued his alleged devil worship. The account also claimed he was buried somewhere on the northeast corner of the property. From the real estate tax assessment office in town, George learned that the house at 112 Ocean Avenue, his dream home, had been built in 1928 by Mr. Monaghan, or Monaghan. It passed through several families until 1965, when the DeFeos, where the one lad had killed every member of the family, shot him one night, purchased it from the Rileys. He knew what had happened since. It was the night before New Year's Eve. The Lutzes went to bed early. George had checked the sewing room for Kathy, as he had done the night before after returning from Newsday, another one of the places he had been doing some research. Both evenings, the windows had been shut and locked. Earlier, they had discussed what George had discovered about the history of their property and the house. George, Kathy asked nervously, "Do you think it's haunted?" "No way," he replied. "I don't believe in ghosts. Besides, everything that's happened around here must have a logical and scientific explanation to it. I'm not so sure. What about the lion?" "Well, what about it?" he asked. Kathy looked around the kitchen where they were sitting. "Well, what about what I felt those two times? I told you I know somebody touched me, George." Now, she had seen a porcelain lion, and she thought her eyes were playing tricks on her. Move, not much, just a little across the floor. George came in after she decided that it was imagination. He came in that night and made one of his trips to try to stoke the fire. She heard him cursing and yelling as he stumbled and fell across the lion that had somehow been placed in the middle of the floor, and he fell over it in the darkness. That's what she meant. But what about the lion? And she reminded him of the two touching experiences. George stood up stretching. "Oh, come on, honey. I think it's just your imagination." They went to sleep. Father Mancuso, who had blessed the place, who had been told by some voice, an unseen presence in the room, to get out, had developed a terrible itching and blisters on the palms of his hand and continued to be sick. New Year's Day came. On television, Guy Lombardo saluted the new year from the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Important that we know that. The Lutzes watched the ball fall from the Allied Chemical Building in Times Square, but didn't share the countdown with announcer Ben Grauer while he told off the last 10 seconds of 1975. Danny and Chris, the two boys, had gone to the room about a half hour earlier. Kathy had put Missy into her bed. and then came back downstairs to her chair across from George. It was now exactly 1 minute after 12. She stared into the fireplace, hypnotized by the dancing flames. Something was materializing in those flames. A white outline against the blackened bricks, becoming clearer, more distinct. Kathy tried to open her mouth to say something to her husband. She couldn't. She couldn't even tear her eyes away from the demon with horns and a white peaked hood on its head. It was getting larger, looming toward her. She saw that half of its face was blown away as if hit by a shotgun blast at close range. Kathy screamed. George looked up. "What's the matter?" he said. All Kathy could do was point to the fireplace. George followed her gaze, and he saw it too. Well, let's skip on. Another day. By 10 p.m., all I really want to do is let you know things were going on. By 10 p.m., both George and Kathy were feeling drowsy. His blazing fire was running out, but the heat was affecting their eyes. She waited until George had poked out the last embers and had poured water over the still smoldering pieces of wood. Then Kathy turned off the chandelier and looked around to take her husband's hand in the darkness. She screamed. Kathy was looking past George's shoulder at the living room windows. Staring back at her were a pair of unblinking red eyes. At his wife's scream, George whirled around. He also saw the little beady eyes staring directly into his. He jumped for the light switch, and the eyes disappeared in the shining reflection in the glass pane. "Hey!" George shouted. He burst through the front door into the snow outside. The windows of the living room faced the front of the house. It didn't take George more than a second or two to get there, but there was nothing at the window. "Kathy," he shouted, "get my flashlight." George strained his eyes to see toward the back of the house in the direction of Amityville River. Kathy came out of the house with his light and his parka. Standing beneath the window where they had seen the eyes, they searched the fresh, unbroken snow. Then, the yellow beam of the flashlight picked up a line of footprints extending clear around the corner of the house. No man or woman had made those tracks. The prints had been left by cloven hoofs, just like those of an enormous pig. Let's skip on. January 2nd. When George came out of the house in the morning, the cloven hoof tracks were still visible in the frozen snow. The animal's footprints led right past Harry, the dog's compound, and ended at the entrance to the garage. George was speechless when he saw that the door to the garage was almost torn off its metal frame. George himself had closed and locked the heavy overhead door. To wrench it away from its frame would not only have created a great racket, but would require a strength far beyond that of any human being. George stood in the snow, staring at the tracks and the wrecked door. His mind raced back to the morning when he'd found his front door torn open, and to the night he'd seen the pig standing behind Missy at her window. He remembers saying out loud, "What the hell is going on around here?" as he squeezed past the twisted door into the garage. "Is there anybody in here?" George shouted. Only the sound of rising wind outside the garage answered him. By the way, the winds are reaching 70 to 80 knots outside. That's why we've had the power failure here. By the time George drove off to his office, he was more... That wasn't in this story. That's what's happening here in Los Angeles tonight. By the time George drove off to his office, he was more angry than frightened. If he'd had any terror of the unknown, it had been dismissed by the thought of what it was going to cost him to repair the damaged door. He didn't know if the insurance company would pay for something like this, and he just didn't need $200 or $300 extra expense. At the office, he quickly occupied himself with his immediate problems, and for the next several hours was able to put aside any thoughts about 112 Ocean Avenue. Before he'd left home, George had told Kathy about the garage door and the tracks in the snow. She had tried calling her mother, but there wasn't an answer. Then Kathy remembered that Joan always shopped on Friday morning rather than buck the Saturday crowds at the supermarket, so she went upstairs to her bedroom intending to change the linen in all the rooms and vacuum the rugs. She just finished putting fresh cases on her pillows and was plumping them up when she was embraced from behind. She froze, then instinctively called out, "Danny!" The grip around her waist tightened. It was stronger than the familiar woman's touch she had experienced in the kitchen. Kathy sensed that a man was holding her, increasing the pressure as she struggled. "Let me go, please," she whimpered. The pressure eased suddenly. Then the hands released her waist. She felt them move up to her shoulders. Slowly, her body was being turned around to face the unseen presence. In her terror, Kathy became aware of the overwhelming stench of the same cheap perfume. Then another pair of hands gripped her wrists. Kathy says she sensed a struggle going on over possession of her body, that somehow she had been trapped between two powerful forces. Escape was impossible. And she felt she was going to die. The pressure on her body became overwhelming, and Kathy passed out. When she came to, she was lying half off the bed with her head almost touching the floor. Danny had come into the room in answer to her call. Kathy knew the presences were gone. She couldn't have been out more than a minute. "Call Daddy at his office, Danny. Hurry." Well, let's go on. All I'm trying to illustrate is a lot of things are going on in this place. You don't know how to handle a devil move. Father Mancuso, the priest, continued to come under attack. They called him and asked for help, saying, "Father, we're in a lot of trouble. We need your help." "What's the matter?" the priest said. "There are things happening around this house we don't understand. We've seen a lot of..." And the telephone began to crackle at both ends. "What'd you say, George? I didn't hear you." There'd be no more conversation between the two men. There was no longer anything to be heard on the line but static and a loud whirring sound. Both men knew it was no use and hung up the telephone. That's one of the reasons why I tell you to help me resist the devil. With the power of connected faith on these telephones. George turned to Kathy and looked around the room. It started again. It killed the phone. By that time, Father Mancuso put down the receiver, and his hands were burning again, with those strange blisters and pain that had been on him as soon as he had begun to recover from the other sickness. "God forgive me," he said aloud, "but George is going to have to get help from someone else. There's no way I'm going back to that house." "You mean me as a pastor?" January 2nd to 3rd. Disappointed, they couldn't convince Father Mancuso to return to their house. George and Kathy discussed other ways of getting help, now convinced that something beyond them had to be done. Both had agreed that now that it had already moved in, it would be unseemly to ask the local parish priest in Amityville to bless the house again. Besides, he had been the confessor to the DeFeos, and George recalled from the newspaper accounts that he was an elderly man who pooh-poohed the thought of voices in the house telling Ronnie what to do. He wasn't much of a believer in occult phenomena. See, as Arnie Johnson, the murderer in the house, had claimed that voices had told him what to do. In spite of Father Mancuso's reticence, they finally prevailed. On the morning of January 2nd, Father Mancuso again blessed the Lutz's home, but he didn't come to Amityville to do it. He did it at the church in the Long Island Rectory, known as Long Distance Blessing. I added that. In the church, the priest held a votive mass, a mass that does not correspond with one prescribed for the day, but is said for a special intention at the choice of the celebrant. Father Mancuso had removed his gloves. He knelt at the altar and opened his missal. He began, "I am the Savior of all people, says the Lord. Whatever the troubles, I'll answer their cry, and I'll always be their Lord." The priest crossed himself, read aloud the opening chapter of the mass. "God our Father, our strength in adversity, our health in weakness, our comfort in sorrow, be merciful to your people." Few other prayers, and after the votive mass, Father Mancuso returned to his apartment. When he got there, he found a stupefying odor of human excrement pervading his rooms. He gagged, but managed to throw open all the windows. The freezing air rushed in, providing a momentary relief, but then the stench overpowered even the cold wind. Father Mancuso ran to his bathroom to see if somehow the toilet had backed up, but no, there was nothing amiss until you tried to breathe. He checked the plumbing, he checked the cesspool, no apparent leaks. Father Mancuso feared the horrible odor might begin to pervade the entire rectory. Other priests might be driven from the room. Finally, Father Mancuso decided to burn incense to dispel the noxious stench. Up to that point, Father Mancuso had not attributed the source of the smell to his own apartment, but after lighting the incense in his rooms and returning to the school building with the others, the priest realized that his apartment had been the first struck, evidently while he had been celebrating the special mass for the Lutzes. He then made the terrifying connection. A disembodied voice in 112 Ocean Avenue had told him to get out. Whoever that voice belonged to, it had reached clear across to the rectory to give him the same message. There was another connection Father Mancuso had been trying to make. He realized it when he stood by the windows in the lobby and looked across to his apartment in the rectory, remembering one of the lessons he had learned in demonology in seminary. The odor of human excrement was always associated with the appearance of the devil. In the afternoon, Detective Sergeant Lou Zamatalo of the Amityville Police Department went along with George, saw the wrecked garage door and the animal track still visible in the frozen snow. Again, I think Ghostbusters can check this out. And then went into the house. The detective sergeant was introduced to Kathy and the children. She repeated her story of the ghost-like touchings and took the sergeant into the living room to show him the image burned into the fireplace wall from that demon that had appeared when I was skipping through earlier. Even after George and Kathy showed him the red room in the basement, they sensed Zamataro's skepticism. He had listened to George's version of the evil use of the hideaway, nodded when George mentioned Ronnie DeFeo as the builder of the secret room, then asked the Lutzes whether they had any concrete facts to base their fears on. "I can't work on what you believe you've seen or heard. Maybe you ought to get a priest in here," he suggested. "Sounds more like his kind of job than a cop's." Sergeant Lou Zamataro left the Lutz house and got into his car. Immediately after Sergeant Zamataro had left, George noticed the compressor in the boathouse had stopped. Am I boring you? I'm reading from the Amityville Horror. There was no reason for the machine stopping, unless it had overloaded the circuits and blown a fuse. That meant he'd have to go down to the basement in the main house and examine the fuse box. George knew the box was in the area of the storage closet and took a fresh box of fuses down with him. He quickly discovered the blown fuse, replaced it. He heard the compressor start up again, making a loud racket as it began to churn. After a few minutes, he started to go back upstairs. When he was halfway up the cellar steps, George became aware of the smell. It wasn't fuel oil. He had his flashlight with him, but the lights in the basement were still on. From his position on the stairs, George had been able to see almost the entire cellar. He sniffed, and then sensed the foul odor was coming from the area near the northeast corner, by the plywood storage closets that shielded the secret room. George went back down the stairs and warily approached the storage closets. As he stood before the shelving that hid the small room, the odor became stronger. Holding his nose, George forced open the paneling and shone his flashlight round the red painted walls. I skipped that because the murderer had claimed that he'd been ordered by voices to paint those walls. The stench of human excrement was heavy in the confined space. It formed a choking fog. Nauseated, George's stomach began to heave. He had just time enough to pull the panel back into place and shut out the mist before he vomited, fouling his clothes and the floor. There is a scene with Father Mancuso and the pastor who was his superior about the horrible stench. George cleaned himself up, went upstairs. "What are we going to do?" Kathy said, as he told her what had happened. "Things are getting worse. I'm really scared something can happen to the kids. God knows what's going to happen next around here." George took Kathy's arm, pulled her up from the chair. "I want to talk to Eric at my office," he said. "He says his girlfriend's got a lot of experience investigating haunted houses." "Haunted houses?" Kathy interrupted. "You think this house is haunted?" "By what?" She followed him toward the living room, then stopped in the hallway. "I just had a thought, George. Do you think our TM, Transcendental Meditation, had anything to do with all this?" George shook his head. "No, nothing at all. What I do know is that we've got to get help somewhere. It might as well be haunted." As they entered the living room, Kathy screamed.
This is the end of Side 3. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 4. Thank you.